Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI marks the start of Holy Week and focuses on the achievements and limitations of man. Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright leads us day by day through the Gospel of Holy Week. And as the date for Pope John Paul II's beatification draws closer, someone who knew him well and worked with him closely for a number of years thinks back. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday marked the start of Holy Week and focused on the achievements and limitations of man. Lydia O'Kane has this report.
On a sunny Roman spring day, St. Peter's Square was transformed for the celebration of Palm Sunday, which marks the beginning of Holy Week. Thousands of people packed into the piazza, both young and old, waving palms and olive branches, as is traditional on this occasion. As the choir sang the Hosanna, a solemn procession ranging from deacons to cardinals made its way around the square. Pope Benedict, resplendent in red vestments and travelling in the fondly named Popemobile, blessed palms and olive branches as he made his way to the specially constructed altar. The liturgy during the celebration recalled Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem, and three deacons sang the gospel which recounts Christ's passion. During his homily, the Holy Father focused on man's great achievements. Mankind, he said, has managed to accomplish so many things. We can fly, and yet the force of gravity which draws us down is powerful.
Insieme con le nostre capacità,
the Pope also added that our limitations have remained and gave the example of the disasters which, he said, have caused so much suffering for humanity in recent months. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. Holy Week, which begins today, is the last week of Lent, the week immediately preceding Easter Sunday. It is a time to commemorate and enact the suffering and death of Jesus before his resurrection. As my Benedictine friend, Abbot Timothy Wright, explained to me, it is only in walking through the shadows and darkness of Holy Week and Good Friday, only in realizing the horror of sin and its consequences in the world, incarnated in the dying Jesus on the cross, only in contemplating the ending and despair that the disciples felt on Holy Saturday, that we can truly understand the light and hope of Sunday morning. To be able to even better understand that light and that hope, I asked Father Timothy to be patient with me, to take me by the hand, and to lead me day by day through the gospel in this holiest of weeks of the year.
One theme from the gospel on Monday is we have Mary anointing the feet of Jesus. And Jesus replies to Judas's query, "Leave her alone. Let her keep this for the day of my burial." A humble act of service amid a group of people, friends, but suspicious, not understanding. And it reminds me of how many people in our world do many acts of humble service, making sure the milk is collected from outside the door, offering to go and collect some food or provisions for a housebound couple, helping to take a handicapped son for the day, giving a loaf of bread to someone who's on the street with nowhere to go. These aren't acts of great charity. They're not blazoned everywhere. They are the bread and butter of living, appreciating, loving each other. Mary anointed Jesus. We anoint people when we love them. On Tuesday, we have the first sense of trouble, again at a meal. And there is a prophecy that by Jesus that he is about to be betrayed. Jesus departs. There is a discussion, and then Jesus tells to Peter, "You will deny me three times." "It is the one to whom I give the piece of bread that I dip in the dish, the one who will betray me," says Jesus. Yes, sin at the heart of Jesus' closest friends. and sin is in the heart of each one of us. And we make an awful lot of sin. We make an awful lot of guilt. But we fail to understand that sin and guilt are past history. They're past history because every sin that has been, is being, and will be committed has been forgiven, has been redeemed in this one act of love, which is the death and sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross. Sin is past history. Guilt is not lasting. The future is in the forgiveness that we are offered. Yes, we do betray. Yes, we too deny, as Judas and Peter did. Yes, we have to say sorry. But in saying sorry, we are doing it with the confidence of knowing that Jesus has done the work of forgiveness for us on our behalf. And as we reflect on this Tuesday of Holy Week, we can think and remember what a tremendous gift this death, this suffering, this entombment, which we will celebrate later in the week, is for us. Sin and guilt are past. Life, forgiveness, are the future and the present. And then we come to Wednesday. And there we read that Judas is negotiating with the chief priests a price for betraying Jesus. And the preparation is made for the Passover meal. Judas asks them, "What are you prepared to give me if I hand him over to you?" The short-term gain. And we can see ourselves always trying to find a shortcut out of difficulty, a quick answer, the lie, the deceit, the betrayal, the uncharity in our word and in our deed. Yes, that is also part of our life. Part of our life in family, part of our life in community, part of our life in the world community to which we all belong. We are betrayers, but the betrayal was in the context of a Passover meal, the meal which we continue to celebrate, to share, to give thanks for the Christ who has also made betrayal past history, challenging us to do our best to think well of people, not to criticize but to affirm, not to blame but to build up, not to put down or exploit but to serve, to hand ourselves over to, be their servant. And that is precisely our lead into the fourth day, Maundy Thursday. At the evening meal of the Passover, Jesus washes the feet of his disciples. "You call me Master and Lord, and rightly, so I am. If I then, the Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you must wash each other's feet." The Lord and Master washing the dirty, ragged, broken feet of his friends. An action which is repeated each year on Maundy Thursday evening at the Eucharist, when the principal celebrant washes the feet of 12 representatives. Representatives not just of the community, but of all suffering humanity, of every man, woman, child throughout the world, whose feet are dirty for no fault of their own, whose feet are full of pain through no fault of their own. And the church, through the priests, kneels, washes, and wipes those feet, not just as a symbolic act, but as a commitment to serve the poor, the needy, whether they are the homeless, whether they are the sick in hospital, whether they are the unemployed, whether they are the fractious, argumentative members of a community, whether they are the pain-filled hearts of broken husbands and wives, of abused children, or of sadly over-exalted men and women who enjoy exploiting others. Yes, washing feet is the church's way of saying, we are on your side. We love you because you are the Christ who on this night, all those years ago, washed the feet of his disciples. The Master and Lord washing their feet, and we wash each other's, not just symbolically, but in attitude, in action, in thought, in prayer, and in love. And we move to Good Friday. The Good Friday with the great account of Jesus' arrest, his trial, the two trials, his condemnation, his death. And what is it about his death which is so unique? Not just the pain, many people were crucified at his time, not just the horror of capital punishment, such a terrible curse on our world, not just the killing of innocent lives, not just the structures of society which force people to live on the very edge of death. No, the real truth, the real message is Jesus' words as he was dying on the cross. Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing. Forgiveness. What a wonderful thing to be able to do after such a painful moment. What a wonderful thing to do just as you are about to die through such pain, agony, through misrepresentation, to be able to say, forgive those who are putting me to death. And yet forgiveness is the only way we can find peace of mind. It's the only way to peace in community, peace between peoples. Cease to be a victim. Cease to harbour the sense of exploitation and reach out to forgive. Forgive the one who persecutes, who wants to kill, who wants to exploit, who wants to violate, for whatever motive. Why? Because deep down in that person, that enemy, if you like, deep down in that other person, there is a presence of God, hidden, yes, unnoticed, inactive, silent. But to us of faith, difficult as it might be to say and to understand, there is God. And wherever God is, we affirm God's presence. Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing. We can say that as well as Jesus did. And what a challenge it is to us. And Good Friday sends that message loud and clear that it has to be at the heart of our Christian living. And from the death on Good Friday, we move to Holy Saturday. Silence. The tomb. Jesus buried in that tomb. The silence of being forgotten, of feeling nothing, of being unable to speak, of being unable to communicate, of feeling I am worthless, of feeling I'm too much of a sinner, of feeling I am beyond the possibility of love and forgiveness for all that I have done. But that silence is a moment for us to look inward, to acknowledge that Jesus died and went into that silence. And there is always another aspect to silence, a positive aspect. Not just feeling nothing, forgotten and annihilated and alienated and exploited and pain-filled, but the silence of meeting the other, of meeting a presence, of meeting, perhaps I dare say it, a different sort of love, an unconditional love, a love that cannot be put into words, a love which, when part of me enables me to grow as other, to put aside the negative elements of myself. But in that silence, there is a question mark. There's a silence of not being sure, of uncertainty, of hope, yes, but not yet fulfillment, of desire, yes, but fear that truly I am forgotten. And in that precarious, fragile world, I sit alongside the tomb where Jesus is buried, sharing the silence that is his. And from that silence, we move to Easter Sunday. And beside the tomb, the stone moved away, and the corpse gone. The risen Jesus. The risen Jesus who discovers his friends on the way to Emmaus. The risen Jesus who transforms in a moment the whole plan, the whole framework of human living. No longer forgotten, now remembered. No longer alone, now among the risen, within the risen Christ. No longer buried in pain, now risen to new life in love forever. And it is on that journey down to Emmaus where Jesus explains the scriptures to his two companions. They'd failed to understand them. They'd looked at them from the wrong perspective, because the only perspective is to read the scriptures as Jesus is risen from the dead. That resurrection in Jesus is the vocation of each one of us. And he says to them, I am the resurrection and the life. And that is all that's needed. Because once we have life and risen life, we have love. And once we have love, we see God everywhere. And once we see God everywhere, we're able to care. To care for those who need our support and our love. Because they too are the risen Christ. We are able to see our failure, our sin and our betrayals for what they truly are. Elements of a nature which is immature, which is ill-formed, which is fragile, which is oversensitive, which is possessive, and now can see within the gift which is risen that there is a better life. But for now it is a life of service, not of having, but of giving. Of giving to those most in need, and more important, of forgiving those who seek to harm us for whatever they've done to us. Because in that moment of resurrection, in order to be able to appreciate it, I have to live the peace which is forgiveness. And that requires silence, not the silence of being forgotten, buried in a tomb, but the silence of the presence of the risen life within my heart, within the love that burns within me, within the love that has been shared with me from the risen Christ, the silence of appreciating the love that I know now go out to give on behalf of Jesus to all those who live with me, who help me, who support me, who need me, and even those who try to undermine me, abuse me, betray me. Because whatever happens now, Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. And all my vocation is simply to relive this week, every day, every hour. Because that is the message of the risen Christ, who has no walls. His love reaches the ends of the earth. To those who know him, and those who half know him, to those who don't know him, and to those who don't want to know him. For us, There are no walls to Christ. There's no limit to his forgiveness. There's no limit to our service. There's no limit to the caring that we give, recognizing that it is his work now, not ours. Thanks be to God. Amen.
And now, as we lead up to the beatification of Pope John Paul II, scheduled for Sunday, May the 1st, we remember the man, the Pope, the Bishop of Rome. And we relive those memories through the eyes and the recollections of those who knew him and worked with him during his pontificate. To do this, I spoke to Senator Francesco Rutelli, Mayor of Rome from 1993 and Special Commissioner for the Great Jubilee of the year 2000, a momentous event which left an indelible mark on the city and its people. Francesco Rutelli, who is currently a member of the Italian Senate and since 2009 founder and president of the political movement called Alleanza per l'Italia, received me in his office inside the palazzo which houses the Italian Senate, not far from the radio. What is your strongest, your most significant memory of Pope John Paul II?
He was a saint, and I could stop here, because he was an absolutely remarkable personality who changed the world in the last part of the 20th century. But first of all, he was a man of faith, and he changed the world because he was a believer and he had a great message to deliver to the world. And he passed through the totalitarian dictatorships. He fought against communism, against the Nazi threat to Europe, and he fought for a human way, for public responsibility, every time asking politicians and people in power what he said when he made Thomas More as a patrono, as the saint to whom all politicians should be looking for. Thomas More risked and gave his life for his deep thought as a politician and as a Christian. And so John Paul II did as a pope.
First of all, Senator Rutelli told me he was the Bishop of Rome.
When I met him for the first time, he told me, don't forget, the Pope is not the Pope for a universal purpose in the sense of Christianity, but he's the Pope for the universal reason of being the Bishop of Rome.
When did you first meet him?
I met him just a couple of days after being elected as mayor in the celebration of Immacolata Concezione, in front of Spanish Steps in Rome, where there is the column devoted to Maria. And it started there, and it was a really deep and direct relation. I met him maybe 40 times, and it was a really, really personal involvement, because he knew that the last mission of his mandate was the Great Jubilee. So maybe the first or the second time we met, he told me, you know, we have something very important to do, preparing the Millennium Jubilee that has to open the door to the third millennium and the huge changes in the world, for the church and for the city. And I think we worked very well to make the civilian purposes and the religious meet and work together.
Is there anything personal that you remember that he said to you, like, Francesco, will you make sure that this happens? Or was there anything really special that was more important to him than other things, maybe, during those years of intense work together?
So many things I could write a book, but I won't do that.
Why not?
Because it's absolutely personal, and I don't think politicians or people in power should translate personal message to a public speech. What I can tell you is what he told me when the Iraqi war started, he was absolutely aware that a new awful era of war of religion could start again. It was approaching the last part of his pontificato, but he had very clear that for Christians it would have been very difficult to stay in this region, and that after Saddam Hussein would have been ousted and new regime installed in not only in Iraq but in the area, that for religious pluralism it would have been very difficult and more dramatic fight for religious purposes to come back. I remember, and I own a very special picture, a photograph that Cardinale Echegaray gave to me, that he was the very last ambassador sent to Saddam Hussein, trying to convince him to give up, to leave the power, to accept a compromise and a peaceful solution and not the war. I think that this dramatic feeling that the old Pope had was prophetic, and my hope is just that his forecast will not be fulfilled.
And Senator Rutelli pointed out Pope John Paul II's vision also led to the posing of the foundations of what has become a central pillar of the pontiff's mission, that of finding space for faith in the public square.
I would like to say that Jubilee of the year 2000 has been an extraordinary opportunity to make what Benedict said during the beatification of Cardinal Newman in London and in Great Britain, that the dialogue between reason and religion is the real challenge for the 21st century. The Jubilee was the very opportunity with the dawn of events, the celebration in open air, but the deep in the soul of millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people was a unique opportunity to show how public servants and religious can cooperate, not abandoning what the celebrated and never enough considerated words of Jesus give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God. I think it's the mainstream for the separation and at the same time the integration, the separation in the public sphere and the integration in the very place of the human soul. I think thanks to John Paul II, the Jubilee of the year 2000 should be remembered as an unforgettable experience, a long-lasting experience of what should be this separation and this extraordinary integration.
It must have been a lot of hard work for you. Were you happy with how it went?
Absolutely, absolutely. But it was a great success, and today the city still remembers, and Rome knows how much the city has changed, and it can't be cancelled.
And that was Francesco Rutelli, currently a member of the Italian Senate and founder and president of the political movement called Alleanza per l'Italia. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.